Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 144.MA0718, certificate number 21628, the Bosnian War Camaro. Hi, Brendan.
Hi, John.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
We've talked a little bit in our pre-show conversation about the fact that you are a Canadian car, automotive writer and magazine, editor, photographer,
communicator. Yeah. I just say that I'm a automotive writer and photographer, and I'm freelance. I have worked for a number of different publications and hope to continue to do so.
You might add communicator to the end there, and then it really, that becomes all-encompassing.
There you go.
Automotive writer and photographer and communicator.
Sure.
Brendan McLear. Is it McLear?
It's McLear.
McLear.
Yeah. You have a McLear Park in just outside Seattle.
We do. Just to establish some baselines, do you have a sports car or multiple sports cars in your own garage?
No, I just said I was a writer. I have one car. It is technically a sports car, but it's like a little four-cylinder Subaru coupe, 2+2.
Oh, are you one of these guys that chips out a contemporary Subaru and turns it into a... No?
I did with my previous two cars. This one's totally factory. A friend of mine was the national rally champion. It lives up in Squamish. And so he tuned both my previous WRXs. And they were fun and rowdy, but not the more you turn up the boost, the less reliable things get. So
right
now I'm very responsible.
Right. Turn up the boost and void the warranty, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, I have all my emission controls in place and so on.
Very nice. Yeah, I forgot to include the third class of classic car owner, which is the writers and musicians who can neither afford to maintain the cars nor do they have the mechanical wherewithal to keep the cars going. And so they just buy one piece of junk after another, and those things never run, and they give them away for free.
You know, it's funny. I did something with Nardwar and the evaporators.
No, you did not.
Yeah.
Wow.
The evaporators have John Collins, who is the bassist for the evaporators and the New Pornographers, he has a dune buggy. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I could do a story on Nardwar's dune buggy. Uh-huh. And so we went down to Neptune Records, and John showed up very glum.
Did you say do-do?
Do-do-do-do? I didn't do that to Nardwar. He did do that to me. But anyway, he and John showed up and was very glum because he couldn't get his, they were going to shoot a video. If anybody's interested, it was the video for Dreadlocks and Mohawks. And he couldn't get his dune buggy to start. So I went and fixed it so that they could have the, and it was a very kind of, It's a dune buggy. It's a Volkswagen with fiberglass on it. So
it was, that's it. That's a dune buggy.
Yeah, there was nothing much to it. But it, one of those things where, yeah, not the mechanical knowledge and not the not the best product in the world. But he did, as far as I know, he still has it, and it's neat because it's on some album covers and things. So yeah.
But you do turn wrenches. You were capable of fixing this Volkswagen. Yeah.
Well, I grew up when I was a kid. My parents had a Land Rover 76.
Oh, so you had to fix a car almost every day.
I drove that for a long time. Once I got in it as a teenager to go to my job bagging groceries, it had longish gear shift, and I shifted it into reverse, and the whole gear shift broke off in my hand, which was a new one. Like, you expect the mechanical faults, but that's a new one.
Yeah.
And so
electrical problems is what they're, yeah. But
it did periodically, just the headlights would completely cut out. And we lived in the country. So you'd be driving up this, you know, windy mountain road and have no headlights, which is a bit terrifying. But my dad's solution was to put vice, like to file down the stub, which went into a plastic ball. So you couldn't just weld it. It would melt the plastic ball.
Right.
And put vice grips on it. And so we yep. just drove it with a vice grip shifter for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or something. Like just, and it was the greatest theft device, anti-theft device, because you could just take it off.
Vice grips off.
Not that anybody was interested in a 70s Land Rover, but. So grew up with a bit of mechanical. I don't really have the time for it as much anymore because I have kids. But when I was I rebuilt an engine in the day with hand tools and things like that. So, yeah.
Good. Well, you promised that there would not be very much automotive autism.
We're already complete lie. Okay. So I'll start by asking this question. What do you know about the use of civilian vehicles in war zones?
Well, as you know, we've talked about the Toyota truck as a fixture in war zones around the world. I've just been to Ukraine and have seen all manner of civilian vehicles kind of pressed into service there. But also, what's interesting about that war, and this is probably true of a lot of wars, is that the influx of foreign aid means that there's no uniformity of origin for a lot of the military vehicles. It's like, well, that's an American truck and that's a German one and that's from Spain. And, you know, you just see like this real goulash of military equipment, but it's all military. It's not civilian. But I think of it primarily, and then there's the other side of it, right? Which is when military vehicles become civilian vehicles, Jeeps and Hummers and so forth, where, you know, they end up kind of infiltrating the market. But I think of those as being primarily like third world situations where it's a Peugeot 604 that gets a machine gun put on the roof, and not a thing that, when you think about wars in Southeast Asia, like vehicles don't really come into play. You don't think of like the NVA having a bunch of cars.
No, but it's certainly the Hilux example with the Chadian army, desert warfare.
Desert warfare, right.
And also in Ukraine, in the early going, you really would just see like a Kia Sportage or something with an anti-tank gun on it and think like, it's going to be kind of embarrassing to be the T-72 that gets taken out by a Kia.
I know. But
you're like, well, I was built to, you know, crush the Hungarian uprising and now I'm getting taken out by a Kia. We'll roll the clock back because this is a over 100 year tradition. The first use of cars in combat was somebody figured out that if you were flying in World War I and you got shot down, well, somebody should go get you. And so my understanding is that at the time, a lot of the pilots were actually in the Navy, official Royal Navy. So you had all these Royal Navy guys and they were officers and gentlemen as well. You had money. You bought your commission. So they were mostly driving Rolls Royces. because the Rolls Royce at that time was, you know, a very reliable vehicle. That was part of the appeal. And then somebody got the bright idea of mounting a machine gun on it, because then you could chase off the Germans when you got there and come home with the pilot. And this resulted in the Rolls-Royce armored car, which is, you know, I think unusual for people to think that a Rolls-Royce would be a fighting vehicle. But
I keep seeing these Lamborghini SUVs. I saw one in Warsaw, and then just the other day I saw one in San Francisco, and it's like, there should only be zero of these, and now I'm seeing...
I 100% agree.
Like, what is going on?
That car is very much an Audi wearing a Lamborghini t-shirt.
It really does. It looks just like that, except it's bright yellow, and it's got these red
calipers.
But
it's the best-selling Lamborghini of all time, and, you know, they got to keep the lights on, so that's their excuse.
Wow.
In this case, the one little fact I think is cool is that the Irish Army still has one of these things.
A Rolls-Royce armored car?
And it is a operational military vehicle, fully operational, because it was sort of hidden for a long time by a quartermaster type. And for it to receive the funds to be worked on, it must... use the firing range like once every couple years and have a crew trained on it. So if you join the Irish Army, it would be very possible that you'd be looking at all these recruitment poster things. If you drive in APCs and Bradleys and whatever else, and they're like, we need you to work on this 100-year-old Rolls Royce. And it is the one that exists. It's called Slieve na Mann because it was in the Irish Civil War. So at the movie The Banshees of Inisherin, that's set during the Irish Civil War, and that violence is just outside that movie, just on the edge for tension. And there were a little over a dozen of those Rolls-Royces used in a significant way in that conflict, and each of them was given names. And the one that remains is actually the one that was present at the death of Michael Collins.
Actually,
you can see the bullet strikes on it. So it's a real living piece of history.
So were these like Rolls-Royce phantom cars that were being...
They were ghosts.
Ghosts. And being used by wealthy people in the country, and then they had just sheet metal welded onto them?
They had a turret pattern that was designed by the Royal Navy put on them, so it looks the same. There was another car used called the Lancaster. And that one actually, those drove long distances because they were used for fighting on the Russian front. The other car that features in World War I conflict is the Cadillac. Because Cadillac also excellent reputation, and including in desert warfare as well, too. Mm-hmm. You know, Lawrence of Arabia used Rolls-Royces in his desert campaigns. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, there was a delivery service between Baghdad and, the coast that was running Cadillacs. And the reason that they used these is because they were very, very fast and reliable, and the bandits couldn't catch them on the way.
Yeah, Cadillac, woo!
Like, seriously, it seriously is the Star Wars trying to avoid the sand people type of thing. Very, you would call it Orientalism, except it kind of actually happened.
Yeah.
So the Cadillacs were called Liberty Cadillacs, and they were sent with the American forces, often privately owned. And they were used to sort of like get officers around. There was one used by a doctor who was very involved in morale for the troops. Mm-hmm. And all of those cars were then basically abandoned after. And the only one that is known to exist was brought back and was displayed in DC, sort of in unrestored but sympathetically restored form. So it's a piece. That's another piece of history. But what emerged is what happened to those cars is they all ended up in Poland, which, I mean, and were there for the rebirth of Poland, because for a long time, Poland was divvied up between Russia and, you know, German Austria's. And post-World War I, it established its independence and had to fight off the Soviets. And so if you go to Poland, a Cadillac is seen as like the birth of that country. Very, very cool. Important. There's like a parade, and the president had one. And yeah, so these things have all been involved. And then, of course, there's motorcycle use for motorcycle couriers.
I'm looking at these Rolls Royces, and they're truly armored cars. They have a turret, like a machine gun turret. Are they precursors to the tank, or were there tanks simultaneous?
It's a different kind of thing, because tanks sort of emerged as these big, you know, they could soak up a lot of abuse. Where what the armored ghosts kind of did is mobility. It's sort of like, this is a long tradition, and they were also using cars. The Cadillacs were not armored or armored. They were just cars, and people were like, getting around is something we need to do. That was useful in World War I. It was useful in fighting the Soviets. And the Cadillacs were very significant battles. And that continued to World War II, where there's an Aston Martin that shows up in Operation Mincemeat, which is getting a corpse into the water to fool the Germans into thinking they were going to invade at an area different than, at D-Day.
Sure. A great adventure story.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of different uses where it's just a car. Which brings us to 1991 and the outbreak of the Bosnian War. 1991, good year for cars, bad year for Balkan politics.
Yes.
So I'm just going to say this real quickly. My parents are from Northern Ireland. They were there in the 70s.
Oh, they were.
Yeah. So when it comes to the conflict, the Bosnian War itself, I'm going to be not dipping into it very much, because it's truly, truly horrific. I mean, among other things, the term ethnic cleansing was developed during it. Like that comes from this war. There were three sides. All kinds of bad stuff happening. I think there would be very strong opinions about it. I don't consider myself to have the depth of knowledge to discuss it in depth, only to say that, as usual, in any civil war, the civilian population suffers.
Yes.
And that was very much the case here.
Bosnia was, if I'm not mistaken, the most ethnically diverse place in former Yugoslavia?
I mean, it could be.
Kind of a crossroads?
Well, you basically have the situation of you have a strong man in place, Joseph Tito, who has what can only be described as resting Stalin face. Like, you just look at him and you're like, oh, yeah, okay. You have the demeanor of somebody who does not brook much dissent.
Right.
And he sort of is just keeping everything together. And then when he is gone, things just disintegrate very badly. And they sort of divide along lines that would be, you know, going back to medieval times, except that everybody has modern weaponry. So, you know, really, really bad stuff. And then the West is reluctant to do much about it initially, because what do you do, right? Like, it's difficult. I think it's worth touching on the bravery of the reporters that went in and covered this stuff. I mean, I looked back briefly through some, what are the photojournalists and journalists were doing, and it's you really had to be really brave to cover this stuff. There's a lot of unfortunate parallels between reporters who are working in war zones right now, where it's really dangerous. So just a really dangerous, chaotic, who's the good guys? No one, right?
I was talking to a friend the other day that I don't see that often, and she was describing the fact that she kind of finally felt like she needed therapy. And it wasn't, you know, anything devastating that had happened. It was just that her job never ends. And even when she's not at work, her mind never fully stops being a quarter in her job. But the problem is she gets off work and just transitions from one screen to the next screen. She logs off and goes and sits on the couch and looks at her phone. And then she goes and looks at the television. And then she lays in bed and looks at her phone and goes to sleep and wakes up the next day. And over the course of months, she's just lost, in some ways, like lost a grounding, lost even a footing in the world. She doesn't know what she's doing, and it feels like a spiral. And it's not, you know, it's not like the worst situation you could be in, but she can't get out of it herself. It's a problem she isn't able to solve. I completely understood, and I wasn't really able to help her either. But I was very glad to be able to recommend Rula to her. Rula is a service that helps you find a therapist. And if you've ever tried to find a therapist, you know that it's kind of crazy that in the moment that you need a therapist, that is the last moment you're going to be prepared to go through all the rigmarole of finding a therapist. And this has always been the thing that thwarts me, right? Like, you go look for a therapist and 9 out of 10 of them aren't accepting new patients. The ones that are, their first appointment is months out. I mean, this is not what you want in a mental health crisis. And Rula is a service that matches you online with a licensed therapist that's in your insurance network, and the copays are you know, low. It's it gets you like matched with somebody that's really actually kind of, you know, matched with what you need, and it makes it happen. Boom, boom, boom. So I was, you know, obviously Rula sponsors the program, but it was so good to have right on hand, like a suggestion. Oh, this is here is a path that is not this frustrating slog of, well, and for most of us sitting and thinking, I need a therapist, and then saying, but I can't find one or afford one. So I recommend to her, and if this matches at all with you, I recommend that you go to Rula.com, RULA.com/omnibus, and look into getting some quality therapy that will be covered by insurance. They have in-network care for most insurance plans, so it's not, you know, it's not like this death slog of looking for stuff that you can't afford. So Rula.com, RULA.com/omnibus. And if you do get, some help this way, I would love to hear about it. I'm always interested in people's therapy journeys. So Rula.com/omnibus. Good luck, and I really am rooting for my friend too.
There were definitely people witnessing something terrible happening and feeling that it was important to witness it, which to tell the world. And that, I think, is a calling of journalism. And there were also people who did something about it, which brings us to the subject of our omnibus today. Now, you know, the titles come out, so everybody is kind of already know what's happening. But were you to have to be either a cub reporter in 1991 Bosnia or travel through Ukraine now, What vehicle would you most not pick to do that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's a car. Well, first of all, I'm trying to think if there is a use case for the Camaro full stop. Now that there are no more drive-ins, there are no more strips. Nobody cruises the strip anymore. It seemed like the Camaro was built exclusively to cruise the strip in American towns, you know, mid-sized American towns where there was nothing to do on a Friday night but drive up and down the main street and peel out at stoplights. And partly that opinion is borne up by the fact that they stopped making the Camaro. Wait. They stopped making the Trans Am, right? They still make a Camaro.
So the Camaro is on hiatus but coming back.
Okay.
It was a reaction to the success of the Mustang. And yes. I think it's good that it's coming back because the Mustang is worse when it's not around to have that rivalry, you know?
Yeah.
It's a superior car in some ways and a much worse car. The previous generation one drove better than the Mustang, but also the packaging was like, it was like driving around in a pillbox. It was very
hard to see out of it, right?
It was just styled. It was styled. Yeah. So,
but when you say, what kind of vehicle would I like if I were a cub reporter in a war zone? You would want something that had four wheel drive and was compact, kind of like a Toyota, Land Cruiser or a Jeep, but you would not want a rear engine or a rear drive front engined low two door like overpowered sports car.
No.
At all.
No. you'd want like a 70 series Land Cruiser, which are still built new because they're used in the mining industry because they're so tough. You can buy one in Australia because, you know, and drive it around the outback and you'd be fine. Mm-hmm. Which brings us to this, like I said, the subject of our story today, Helga Meyer. So I don't know exactly how old Helga is. However, I do know that he entered the Danish army in 1966 as a special forces soldier.
Oh, it's a boy. His name is Helga.
His name is Helga, and he is a, a Jaeger Corps. So he is basically Delta Force, but Danish.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that he was training in the mid-70s with the Green Berets, and he would do these really, really grueling marches that he ran. So he was working with... NATO forces. He seems to have done something in the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm. Something spooky, something French Foreign Legion-y.
Maybe something special forces-y. So he was a tough dude, right?
Plausible tough deniability.
Guy. Yeah, but a very capable person. So in 1991, that would make him like maybe late 40s, maybe early 50s, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he's retired. Before he retired, he had trained as a special forces soldier, but he'd also done some specific training, including anti-terrorist stuff. So security.
Yeah.
And while he was... had been established as that, he'd been hired to help be one of the guards, possibly running some guard service at the Rhineman Air Force Base in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's a U.S. Air Force Base. So he would be known to U.S. Army and Air Force. Basically, he would be a known person. They'd be like, oh, that's, you know, tough old Helga who's... who's like a nightmare when you're having to go train with him because he's hard as nails, right?
Right. He's got security clearance too. They, you know, everybody knows who he is.
He's just like, there's a movie out with the guy from Reacher where he fights like a robot and he's like outrunning everybody and everyone's tagging behind him. And he's like, oh, that's, you know, We got to keep up with the tough guy. Anyway, so there's that. However, by the time the Bosnian War breaks out, he is a security guard at a newspaper news office. So he's sort of like he's moved into civilian life. He's married. He has a couple of kids, and he's living in Germany. Possibly his wife is German. They live in Jutland, I think, North Jutland, so northern Germany. And he's a very religious person.
Okay.
And he sees what's happening in Bosnia, and he is outraged, and he thinks somebody should do something about it.
He's outraged by the persecution of whom?
He's not outraged by the persecution. He is outraged by watching children of any of the, you know, Bosniaks or Serbs or, you know, Croatians, like any of them being just caught in the crossfire because he has, you know, he's a military man and he just feels like this is wrong and somebody should do something. And by the way, I'm also a military guy, so I have Liam Neeson's certain set of skills kind of thing.
So this is interesting because we tend to think of someone now, this is probably a gross mischaracterization, but we think of if someone were a devout person and outraged by a war like the one in Bosnia, I mean, I leapt to think that he was going to go there and defend what he perceived to be his class, his religion. He was intervening in a partisan sense, but you're saying he had a more ancient kind of code of Hammurabi, a feeling that he needed to be an agent of, you know, of justice, like generally, not specifically.
I think there are people who are very religious because it provides a framework so that they can, you know, apply that framework to trials and tribulations. It also gives you faith to carry on, you know, when things are unbearable. I think it provides a lot of a structure. And there are also, I think, people who are just like, this is my moral code, which is reflected here. However, my moral code does not extend to me telling you what to do. It's the, I can't remember the scripture, but there's, you know, worry about the plank in your own eye before worrying about the mote of sawdust in mine. This sort of like, it is intensely turned on itself. So he deeply believes these things, but he's not out there to proselytize or to pick a side. Right. He is effectively taking the side of the innocent.
Right. Yeah, the humanitarian.
Yeah.
And did you just say that you also are a veteran?
No.
Okay. All right.
No, nothing like that. No. I had mentioned only the Northern Ireland thing because when I was a kid, we would go there very frequently in like, you know, the early 80s and stuff. And so it was always kind of like, you know, you grew up in Canada and everything's low key. Peaceful. And we're, you know, watching Mr. Dress Up and Sesame Street. And then you go to Northern Ireland and you have to go through checkpoints to get everywhere. And there's soldiers everywhere. And it's kind of like, well, this is unusual. But I also mentioned it to be like, my parents, when they came here, would be close friends with people who were Protestant or Catholic. It didn't really matter because you were from the same part of the world. So you could talk about, you know, the places that you'd been and the people that you knew and have a familiarity. And you could also understand each other because it's quite a thick accent. So there's sort of like a decompression of that. And I mentioned that in terms of the Balkans in that, you know, people are just people and these pressures are placed on them in that area. And, it's not a good or a bad, there's not a good and there's not an evil. There's just trying to survive. So you have somebody who wants to do something and has the training to do it. And he happens to own a 1979 Chevrolet Camaro. He also happens to know all these people at this military base. So he, Helga goes to them and says, I would like to raise some funds and send some supplies to these people, because what's currently happening is the UN is sending in supplies in these white painted trucks, and they are just getting hijacked left, right, and center because they're big, fat, slow moving targets, and they're not, the aid is not getting to the civilians. And eventually, at some point, it kind of feels like the UN stops sending trucks because it's just futile. So the Camaro is, from what I can tell, is something he already had. The fact that there's a Camaro in Germany is a bit weird, except that U.S. Service members are allowed to bring over their own personal vehicles. This happens also in Japan. So there are, there's like, it's not famous, but it's not famous outside of Japan, but there is this famous Japanese Mach 1 Mustang police car from the 70s that's in that crazy Japanese police livery that they have with the big red siren on top, big red lights on top. And it was just sort of, it doesn't make any sense on the tiny streets of Japan, but they used it on the highways. And so you get Mustangs and Camaros turning up in weird spots. And this is one of those cases where this car had belonged to a serviceman. He brought it with him. And then after he's done, he sells it. There's lots of, you know, German fans of American TV culture, car culture, all that stuff. And so it ends up in his possession. But you can't just drive a Camaro into a war zone and hope for the best. And if you happen to know an army base where there are a bunch of guys who know how to work on tanks and have a, you know, stuff lying around, then the A-Team theme plays, and there's a bit of a Top Gear style modification of the vehicle. So the first thing they did was take all the stuff out of it. So it only has two seats. And
is the car now in Bosnia? Has it already arrived in Bosnia, or is this happening in Germany?
The car is in Germany. This is happening at the Rheinmann Air Force Base. So rolls into the shop. All these guys are like, this is a great idea. Helga's crazy. Let's put this together. They strip the car out. They weld in a bit of sheet metal in the back for sort of like basically what they called cowboy armor in Iraq, where they were just putting stuff in Humvees. So they did that to it. So it's all armored up. Take the rear glass out. It's just sheet steel. There's, you know, thicker steel at the back, but it's also empty, so it can haul a little under 1,000 pounds of stuff. So, which is considerable when you think it's going to be medicine and baby formula and other really sort of calorie dense, value dense stuff.
How much can a normal Camaro carry?
I mean, not that much. I have taken a Mustang camping and was able to, with one child, and was able to fit like tent, guitar, blah, 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 like a bunch of stuff in terms of volume. It's not mentioned in any discussion of this, but it is a live axle leaf spring car in the rear in this generation. So you could add an extra leaf or two to make it support more weight. It being old is actually a benefit here because it's an older design and can be beefed up in truck like ways. They then fill the tires with foam. So it's a rudimentary run flat tire. Modern run flats just have really stiff sidewalls. This is sort of like the foam stuff you could get the tire shot out. And you could still get away to a safe distance and then put a spare, and it had two spares. Then they paint the car. And to paint the car, it's the U.S. Air Force. So they have access to the paint that's used on the F-117A Nighthawk stealth fighter.
The radar reflective rattle can black paint.
The one that is all triangles. So it reflects, it absorbs infrared and like also absorbs radar to some extent. Not that you worry about the radar, but the being invisible to infrared is kind of handy and also insane.
But wait, wouldn't that paint be like, because it's a military commodity, wouldn't it be like $100,000 a pint?
It's sitting around. this is you know, Gulf War.
Sure.
And he's a member of the club.
Yeah, right. Okay.
He's friends with Green Berets. So they're like, all right, I'm gonna shoot this Camaro with flat black paint. Then they put on so it's armored at the back. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's not armored up front. It's armored at the back so it can run away.
Right.
To the front, they add like a push bar, like a basic bull bar that you would see on a cop car.
Right.
At some point, it had these triangular blades that scraped along the road to do some mine detection. I don't know how long those were on there. It seems like that was something they tried and didn't really stick with.
Yeah.
And then they added infrared headlights. So, which you could use with night vision goggles, which were also attached to the car.
Oh, so they wouldn't be visible as headlights if you didn't have night vision
goggles. They were invisible unless you were wearing special goggles.
Cool.
It also had a human heat signature. So it could detect body heat at a very long range with this prototype thing that they lent to him. And said, tell us how it works. Like, does it work for you or not? So there was some of this stuff he got lent to him because they knew that he was going to go do things with it and he could report back because he was very experienced. And that included, there was, he's spoken about it since and sort of mentioned that this was sort of like we want you to do a few things for us since you're in the area. We're not going to ask you to hurt anybody or pick any sides, but maybe you could help out with this and that. And one of those things was he had a ground-to-air radio so he could talk to C-130s when they were dropping goods and sort of be like, oh, like go in this area or don't go in this area right now because the militia is there or whatever it happens to be. So he could do
that. He's a forward spotter.
He's doing a bit of spy work, which would be real bad if basically any of the three sides caught him.
But this is like the coolest car an 11-year-old could design if it also had a rocket launcher.
It is a Mad Max car.
Mad Max.
It's flat black. It has the hood scoop. It looks remarkably similar to the Falcon that Mad Max drives in, crashes at the beginning of Fury Road. Very, very similar. It's got that thing. It's not supercharged, but it has the high rise intake manifold. The hilarious thing about this engine is this is a very low powered engine.
Now we're going to talk about displacement and horsepower.
I'm only going to say that it makes about as much power as you get out of a Honda Civic Hybrid now. So, it's
100
it's
horsepower,
200 horsepower, but like not more than that. Okay. Because, you know, it's 79, the emissions, everything was kind of crappy. Now they tune it a little bit to get up to there, to get up to like 220 or something, but it's not a race car. What the Camaro had was a very straight 200 shot of nitrous. So if he hit the button, he had 13 seconds where the car had 400 horsepower, which is enough to run away from anything you're going to find in Bosnia in that era, right? Like that's a lot of power. It's not a crazy amount of power now. It's what you get out of like a factory Mustang, V8 Mustang, but it was a lot then.
Right.
And you can only use it for a certain amount of time. It's like a getaway boost and go.
Like you say, most of the vehicles were in that war were diesels. And had a max speed of 40 miles an hour, so he could get away.
He could get away.
So one thing to think about when you are, when you're managing a long, hot summer like this one has been, is how do you keep looking groovy? I don't mean just groovy. I mean fashionable, stylish. These things, even in the desolate dog days of summer, you should still look good. You should still be trying to maintain a fresh style. Because as many longtime listeners of Omnibus know, I'm a great advocate of men in particular elevating their style a little bit above just wearing t-shirts that have wolves howling at the moon or sports jerseys or cargo shorts and flip-flops or Crocs. And I'm not calling anybody out. If you're sitting in your car right now in Crocs and a shirt with a sports team howling at the moon on it, I love you. I love you and I love your style. But you could kick it up a notch. And a great way to do that in summer is the fabric linen. Linen is a sophisticated fabric. It communicates a very European feel. And a lot of people kind of don't understand exactly how to incorporate linen. Linen tends to be, you know, it's more breathable. It's looser tailoring. But you could recognize linen across the room, right? It communicates chicness. It communicates, in a way, it is the quintessential summertime fabric. And I am fortunate enough to be able to recommend Quince, Quince, Quince. They're doing an incredible job with their linen line of, you know, direct to consumer men's fashion. It's like, it's very affordable, but the level of quality is really high. They use 100% European linen. They're making pants and shirts, the whole t-shirts, like the whole, every component of a well-dressed man's wardrobe. And it really is, you can see as soon as you look at it, as soon as you go on quince.com and start checking out, and Quince has stuff for women, it has stuff for the home, like the whole website is full of kind of enviable, covetable stuff. And it's all like surprisingly affordable given the level of quality it is. This is the marvelous thing about being able to buy things on the internet, right? It's 50 to 80% less than similar brands, levels of quality and workmanship of other companies with, you know, brand names that they spend millions marketing, right? And the other thing about Quince is they are very conscious of the factories that produce their clothing being ethical and having, you know, good relationships with their workers. So what you're paying for is just the good stuff. It's not the marketing, not the storefronts and so on. And also, you know, Quince has stuff for the shoulder seasons, lightweight cotton sweaters, stuff that you're going to want in September. And that's always the toughest time for men. It's still too warm to wear a jacket, but just a little chilly in the evening. Anyway, I think Quince is hot stuff. And if you're looking to just even get one statement piece, this would be a great place to start. So go to quince.com/omnibus. You'll get free shipping on your order, 365-day return policy, which is kind of insane. It's now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/omnibus. Free shipping, 365-day returns, quince.com/omnibus.
And by the way, to hear, like, what he says is mostly he thought he would get a little bit of money and he would get out there and he would sneak in and he would just get a little bit of medicine to these people. And that would be worth it. And he would have done something. And he could rest easy on his conscience that he hadn't sat on the sidelines. there was a huge response from the U.S. military because a lot of these guys are aware of what's happening. You know, they're connected to the Air Force. So people are talking about all these atrocities and things and civilians, and they're observing from the air and so forth. So there's a huge response, and he gets given a lot more money than he would expect. And he's able to buy those essential things because the base is right there. So, you know, the commissary, he's able to get good rates on everything and have a lot of stuff. I have it as between 92 and 1995, he did 160 of these runs.
No way.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say he drove this into Bosnia and it immediately exploded and that was the last we ever saw of it. But you're saying this was a successful venture.
This was a hugely successful venture. First of all, there's something that Special Forces people call the survivability onion. And mm-hmm. it's sort of like, I actually have it here, I think. They talk about it, any kind of military thing. It's don't be there. So like observe with the drone. Don't be detected, stealth. Don't be targeted, again, stealth, or just, you know, be maneuverable. Don't be hit, chaff, you know, dodging, hiding, that kind of stuff. Don't be penetrated, which is like don't have armor. And then don't be killed, which is like being able to have some kind of first aid and so forth with you to when you get away. So the Camaro surprisingly fits several of the first things because none of the combatants are expecting a Camaro to show up, let alone one that's like stealth fighter black. So people are just kind of like, they're just not seeing it because it's such a weird thing. So he's just kind of scooting through town and someone's like, okay, that's not recognizably a combatant that I'm looking for. It's not a Jeep. It's not a military vehicle. He's running at night all the time. So
I mean, I can picture myself as as someone fighting in this war, you know, hiding behind a stone wall. And this goes by, and it's so completely G.I. Joe. And by G.I. Joe, I mean the small 80s plastic G.I. Joe figurines with the Cobra. This is like Cobra, the bad guys in G.I. Joe. And I think every guy between the ages of 16 and 60, seeing this go by, would put their gun down just to marvel. It's the coolest thing they ever saw. And they wouldn't even care if it was the enemy. They would just be stunned by the coolness. And no one would want to shoot at it. No one wants to be because clearly these are the good guys, whoever they are. To have a vehicle like this, they couldn't possibly be the bad guys. These are the coolest guys in this war. And it doesn't even matter if they're my enemy.
Well, and there's also, I think, again, with the Rolls Royces, in the earliest days when they were just cars with a few armed people in them, they would kind of rock up at some village where the thing had gone down and people would not be expecting to see a car and they would sort of be, or in the desert, right? Like they would not be expecting to see it. And the shock of being surprised gives you a beat, a beat, a beat, a beat, and then you're gone.
Right.
So he's able to kind of just sneak through. And also he has maps. He develops all these back roads that he's taking. He's sneaking around.
Yeah.
So, there other thing that's important about this is at no point have I mentioned in terms of the whole Mad Max aspect of this or the technical, you know, technical being like a Hilux with a gun on it, any weaponry on this car. And there isn't any. There's no weaponry on the car.
Right.
And he has no weaponry either. He has like a survival knife and a tomahawk. That's it.
Oh, he's sure. A tomahawk. Absolutely.
It's like a special forces thing. It's like exactly you look at it and go like, oh yeah, this is somebody who is in special forces would have adopted from a green beret or, you know. It's just like, and not a big one. So he is unarmed except for a couple of bladed weapons. He has a Kevlar jacket. He has a Kevlar helmet. He otherwise has no uniform insignia or whatever. He has his ID. He has a couple of things that are interesting. Defensive.
Other than the Camaro.
Well, he's apparently got some kind of badge that can detect infrared, like a laser. Now, the idea being like that, there's lots of snipers everywhere, so it sort of would like it like beeps or does something if you're being targeted by somebody who has a some kind of sight, so you know to move and do whatever. So he's got a few little interesting things like that, but what he also has with him is his family Bible, and this thing's like a foot thick. It's huge. It's the size of like a modern shoebox. It's sitting on the transmission tunnel. Because, like I said, this is a very, really religious person. And so he's got all this art. He's got a lightly armored car. But what he thinks the real protection is that he's on a mission from God, which would normally be a Dodge Monaco, but it's a Camaro in this case.
Right. It's got a cop motor. It's got cop brakes.
Cop brakes, all that stuff. So,
but this is a religious war. In partly the war in the former Yugoslavia was a religious conflict, although that's only a small component of it. So the Bible would be maybe not as divisive as a rocket launcher, but it would have political.
He also has a Quran, so has. But the Bible is his Bible. The Quran is sort of like a which one are you guys again? Okay, it's tactical. He says that everybody hated him. Like they all, he's not on anyone's side. So that means, at least for the combatants, he's on the wrong side because he's not on their side. Right. So he's got to like avoid all these people. There's one story he says of where he gets, not captured, but somebody holds him at gunpoint in the Camaro. And he, with a pickup truck in front, pickup truck behind, they're going back to the lair of, if this is a movie, you know, and he says he like punches out like a punch, just like does like, this is Schwarzenegger stuff, just decks the guy and then flips all the lights off on the car, whips a U-turn,
hits the nitrous
and runs, and they don't catch him. And then he dumps the guy out in a ditch somewhere unconscious and continues on his thing. There doesn't seem to be a lot of pursuit. It seems to be more, just being real sneaky and people not expecting you to be there. Like, what? This is crazy. I feel like I'm getting visited by a UFO. So he gets through the entire war.
How many missions again?
So it's 160 during wartime. Let me just see if I'm missing anything else. There's also, so a couple other things I found out about the car has like, can generate smoke underneath the hood. So it looks like it's been damaged. It just has like a mister that sprays onto the exhaust and oily smoke comes off. So he can pretend to be disabled if someone's going past and they'll just ignore him. Also,
what a weird, like, anti James Bond thing to think of. It's not like you change your license plate or you send a smoke screen up to get away. You send a smoke screen up to look broken.
Yeah.
I think that's just as smart as anything I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's ingenious, I think, too, in that it's like a maybe built from a windshield washer out of a Volkswagen or something. Like just. Yeah. Clever little things. The car, while he's doing this, he does have some kind of stereo in this car. And on that stereo, he is, this was something that came up when we were talking about the title of this thing. He is listening to the music of Ennio Morricone. Ennio Morricone, the composer behind spaghetti westerns. So that like harmonica sound. And they can also play this outside the car. I don't know why you would want to do that. But it
because
is
it's the flight of the Valkyries in Apocalypse Now.
It's just bananas. So 160 of these runs, critical aid to civilians. He's mostly going to specific points, like he's going to hospitals, orphanages, particular refugee camps, and dropping things off repeatedly. So he basically he finds a routine, and his route is. Let's see, how long does it take him? Each route is 1,500 miles or something. So he's skirting down. Croatia is sort of like takes all the coastline when it fractures. So he's skirting down the coastline and then basically going straight in, kind of back roads into the middle there, and then finding these places to drop these things off, and keep people supplied.
This guy is an adrenaline junkie of the absolute top order.
And there is also the aspect of it of he's married and has two children at the time, and he's not telling his family where he's going. So they're always worried. The boss at he's still technically employed by this news agency, is just like, oh yeah, they're working on some kind of project together, and you know, while he's making these overnight crazy runs. So that's like a level of added bananas to the whole thing. And then once the war, you know, once there's a ceasefire, UN, you know, does a lot of strategic bombing and is able to get people to the peace talks. He continues to do runs for a further decade until 2005.
No, he does not.
Yes,
he does. This is just what he does on the weekends. He goes and tear asses around Bosnia in a modified Camaro.
So the Camaro stops. He stops using the Camaro in 2005. My understanding is that he's still involved in getting aid there, but it's no longer like it's no longer reasonable. Not that it was ever, but it's no longer reasonable to use a Camaro.
He's in his 70s now.
He's in his 70s. Yeah. So I'm not sure what he's physically doing now, whether he's completely retired from it. But he did not stop in 1995. He continued for another decade to bring stuff in. And some of those, we've been talking about, like during the war, medical supplies and baby formula and essential, like super essential stuff. But he is Danish. So, and he is specifically trying to help children, which
means it's chocolate. He's bringing in tons of chocolate.
Lego. Yes. And I mean, to be honest, I cannot believe there is not a Lego set of this car yet, because it's like, it really should be. It should be the next thing on that ideas thing that Lego does, because it's amazing. So
he's Johnny Lego Seed.
I just imagine that you are 10 and you have been born during a time of great upheaval. Like maybe your dad's not around. You're in an orphanage because both parents aren't around, and you hear this V8 rumble
and slow rolling through your wrecked town.
Flat black Camaro rolls up, and this guy gets out, not in a military uniform, because he would never wear his military uniform. He wouldn't wear any fatigues or anything around the kids, because he knew if they've been exposed to somebody who's wearing this gear, that person has been traumatic for them. So I'm just in full civilian clothes. This guy gets out and starts handing you Lego set, or starts giving out Lego sets to, cause it's around, I don't know, it's around Christmas or something. Like it's like halfway between Mad Max and Santa Claus. And, you know, the fact that he continued to do it, the fact that he did it in the first place, I think the decade afterward elevates it from adrenaline junkie to just somebody who cannot but help his humanity be affected by what's going on, and sees a need and is just like, I'm going to do something about it. yeah, he continued to do that until 2005. The Camaro was at some point painted orange. However, it is, as far as I know, black again. He takes it to car shows and things like that. And it's there seems to be the hint that a movie might happen at some point. Like, he's talked with several people, and it's just never, it just hasn't happened because that's the way Hollywood works. But I mean, it's the kind of story where you wonder, why are we getting another reboot of Escape from New York? Who cares, when you could have this actual thing happening? Now, and I wanted to, before we went on, there is one thing that I will read. This is something that almost everybody does, because it's he wrote a book. So according to him, it was the chaplain at the Air Force Base that dubbed him God's Rambo. Because he's Rambo.
Yeah.
He's like Rambo 1. Right? First Rambo movie, which is like morally defensible, where he's super skilled. He's not killing people. He's doing good. And he's very motivated by, religious fervor. And he's written a book called God's Rambo. It is not available in English. It is only in German. And then translation to Danish.
Okay. So not even really, it can't even be read by Bosnian children.
No. And it's available, but I would also add that in any interview he's given, he has always said like, oh, and by the way, I'm telling you my story, but let's not get confused about me thinking that I'm this big hero guy. Like, anytime someone's like, well, what you did was heroic, he usually like steps in and he's like, no, it's like, I'm not a hero, I just did something because it had to get done. So he's obviously proud of what he's done, but doesn't want it to be misconstrued that he's like vain about it or something.
And so he still owns the Camaro.
Still has the Camaro.
And it's in Denmark?
It's in Germany.
It's in Germany. Oh, he lives in Germany. I have to say, I'm not a movie producer, as you know, although I could be confused with one. But it seems to me that this is the reason that this hasn't been made into a movie yet is that it needs to be a comedy. There's no way that this isn't a comedy.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that he has a giant, like a Gutenberg Bible, the only way you can play that is that this is one of these superhero characters who is in a world of terrible, terrible horror, but there's a light that shines on him everywhere, and that he is somehow, you know, kind of in a naive bubble with the Legos. Like, you'd have to play this, and the Camaro, it's got to be a gentle, like a family comedy, you know, like a 70s Disney movie. And the people that would want to make this movie are trying to make it as a like Rambo, but just the fact that he's God's Rambo, I mean, I'm already writing the script. It's you don't want to play him for laughs, but the thing has got to be gentle.
Yeah, I think it could. I'm not sure how you would do it. It's just that's the number one. When anybody hears this story, they're like, how is this not like this actually happened? Yeah. So I want to read something here, which is an excerpt from it, because I think this is what sort of elevates the story for me to Omnibus. So this is an excerpt from 1994. He says, in the middle of ruins, I examined the surrounding area with my detector, which reacts to body heat. It displayed body heat in the opposite ruin. I saw candlelight through the boarded up door. I knocked and the candle went out immediately. After knocking again and saying, Mr. Meyer, U.S. Army, an old man opened the door and asked me inside. A young woman was present with her newborn baby. Everyone was dirty and clearly malnourished, and I got soap, water, food, and baby food from my Camaro. The young mother washed herself and her child and gave the newborn something to eat. We sat around the candle silent for a while. The old man read carefully in his Quran and I in my Bible, which is my constant companion. Then I pulled back into my car, was about to slip into my sleeping bag when someone knocked on my window. It was the young woman who put her baby on my bare chest. I will never forget this moving moment in my life. Now, John, you're a father. Do you remember that moment when they gave you your child and you held it against you?
Well, of course.
I mean, that is some hominid level elemental stuff right there.
Well, especially if you have what they call skin on skin contact. If you are given a naked baby and you put that naked baby on your skin, it's a real bonding moment. It's a heavy, heavy moment.
And yeah, it's super heavy. And also, like, this is what it means to be a human being. And I mean, all the funniness about it, the comedy elements of like driving a Camaro around and it being Mad Max, or it's cool, or it's G.I. Joe. And that, I think, goes right to the core of, like, this is just in the midst of inhumane conditions, something that is predates speech in terms of how we interact with each other as human beings.
You didn't tell me that he slept in the Camaro, that he he had like some kind of, did he also have like a fold down seat where it became a bed?
He doesn't really talk about that part of it very much. The logistics of it. Like, I don't know how he went to the bathroom, but you know, he's a soldier. So I imagine he had a shovel.
I mean, I want to build this Camaro. And so I'm just wondering, like, what parts do I have to fabricate in order to get all of the features?
Well, I think that's that part that I just read was the part that I was kind of like, This car sounds really cool, and there's a movie car thing where you look at the time machine DeLorean and you look at all the details. Or I have some people I know out here who own the Wayne's World Pacer.
Of course.
And it has a licorice dispenser, and it has all these gizmos, right?
They
also have an Ecto-1. And it's got all this gear in it so that you could build these movie replica cars, and you want them to have gadgets and gear and features and cool stuff. And I'm like, it's not that the car doesn't matter at all, but this, it elevates the story to be like, I'm going to pay attention to this story because it's so odd that it's a Camaro. But the story is also just like a man, saw something happening and was like, I'm going to do something. And he did so in a very unusual way, but he did. And I think that is, you know, action is the antidote to despair. And when things seem crazy, you know, the old Mr. Rogers thing of look for the helpers. I mean, there it is right there.
There it is right there. In an increasingly partisan world, his nonpartisanship is another thing that it kind of almost feels like it harkens back to a time when you could just go and try and be helpful to all the people that are innocent or not involved at all, without being part of any multinational organization, without having, you know, it didn't even sound like, as a special forces guy, that he necessarily had an anti-war agenda. He just was like, we need to get formula to all these naked Bosnian babies, and I'll take the hugs where I can. That right there seems like it could almost be a doctrine.
Yeah. Yeah, just like I can't sit by and do nothing. And I also, and maybe, and the sense of like, well, I'm never going to be able to figure this out, in terms of which side needs my help. I just see footage of people suffering and I'm going to go in and alleviate that suffering in the best way I know how.
So did he ever take fire? Did he ever come under fire?
Yeah. So his helmet has like a hole in it. Now I've read up on this because of course there are forums which will tell you exactly everything you want to know about the type of gear he had. And there is no way his protective gear would have stopped somebody shooting him with a rifle. It just would have gone through. Like it was sort of like a pistol caliber. It could shrug off, but not. So it's likely a deflection. Could have been shot through the glanced off something else around him or through the steel of the car. But he did have a bullet lodged in his helmet. And he did say that like he was constantly getting shot at just from far away or, there was always shooting going on. So again, very, very dangerous, a little bit of sheer luck or maybe he was right and the Bible was like a force field, you know?
And that concludes the Bosnian War Camaro, entry 144.MA0718, certificate number 21628 in the omnibus. Futurelings, one of the things that makes this marvelous is that there's no social media component to this story whatsoever. It happened before social media. Can you imagine how much worse this would be if he was posting Instagram reels every day of his humanitarian efforts? I actually can see a world in which the social media posts about this would have been kind of cool. Maybe this would have been the one cool thing about a Twitter era Bosnian war. But now we know that social media produces almost nothing of value except for where futurelings congregate on the internet, on Facebook, Reddit, Discord. Brendan, do you ever go on futureling oriented social media?
I like the Facebook page. It's pretty cool.
It's good, right?
Get some Angine Dupuytren on there. And yeah, it's good stuff.
I was talking to my brother about Angine Dupuytren yesterday, and he said, oh my God, I love that band so much. And my daughter just about died because she thought I was the only one in the world that was forcing her to listen to it.
Math rock, dude.
I'll tell you what. You can actually watch this show that we just did. It's not quite as dynamic as an Angine Dupuytren concert, but pretty fun to watch. Brendan, you suggested that your cat might make like some kind of trouble for us, but the cat was only here at the beginning and then sauntered off, and it's just been the two of us.
Yeah, my kid came home and so has obtained the cat.
Right, so. Right. But you can watch this show at youtube.com/theomnibusproject. You can go to omnibusproject.com/submit and propose your own show. How long did the process between your proposing this show and recording it? How long was that?
It was quite a while.
Yeah.
But you know, here we are and it happened and
here we are.
And I knew immediately as soon as you guys announced what you're going to do, I was like, oh, well, I got one. Let's see, because this is ridiculous. And sure enough, Grant was tickled by it. And here we are.
I feel like Grant, the manager in the early days of Omnibus 2.0, kind of felt a personal mandate not to pick shows where there was an Eastern European hot rod war story being told by a Scots-Irish middle-aged Canadian. I feel like it just ticked all the boxes where he was like, I just feel like that's just too right down the middle. But now we've established the new show and he's like, okay, we can bring in some ringers to the list.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Also, you know, get the beard. Beard, you've taken off your beard and I have mine. So our beard ratio is good.
Yeah, you're propping up the beard ratio for the show. Yeah. What was it disorienting when you saw me for the first time without the beard?
No, because I listened to the most recent podcast where Ken revealed that you're an smooth man.
Yeah. I'm not even sure how he feels about it. He kind of gave me the one raised eyebrow.
Yeah.
But that's omnibusproject.com/submit. You can send us email at theomnibusproject.com. You can send us physical mail, care of the Omnibus Project, to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And then last but not least, you can support the show yourself by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. There's a lot of other material there, as well as, in this case, over half an hour of Brennan and me talking about cars. And he basically tells an entire omnibus story in our entrance, or in our entry, completely different omnibus story, completely a story that could have been his episode, but condensed into a half an hour. And you can access that by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and joining our merry band.
Is there one more? Can I throw one more thing in here that's might be
for
of interest?
For sure.
So we have this thing in Vancouver called Vancouver Food Runners. It is a program which, via an app, because everything's via an app, connects grocery stores, bakeries, any place there is food sold with food banks. And essentially, the grocery store, restaurant, even casino, will put aside food that's going to spoil or is, you know, surplus to needs. And the food runners in question are volunteers who will get a little ping on your phone, or you set something up regularly, and you take your overcapacity car, because everybody has too much car these days. We're all driving crossovers. Yep. And go pick the stuff up and take it to a food bank, to the downtown east side, to wherever. This is something I do regularly with my kids. It is a very small thing. It is a very easy thing to do. And it allows you to make a small impact immediately, effectively, and personally. And this program exists all over the United States as well, too. The app is active in something like 15 different things. And there are all sorts of other related programs. So if this particular omnibus, you thought, well, I'm not going to go into a war zone, but I see a lot of need around, there are very small things you can do. And action is a great antidote to doom scrolling. So there we go.
That's fantastic. So say it again. Say the how people find it.
Well, the name of this particular app is it's called the Food Rescue App. You can search their website, and I think they have a list of where it is in the United States. I would sort of just go look up your local food bank type of thing and see what programs they have. There isn't one in Seattle. There are a couple in California, but I'm sure there is an equivalent program in Seattle or something similar. And since we talked about cars getting supplies to people, that's one way you can do it.
That's fantastic. I think about that a lot in terms of all the wasted food that just has no way of getting from where it is still fine to where people need it before it isn't fine. And it's cool to see that that's an organization that does that. I'll be sure to look that up myself.
Yeah, it's great. And I think the thing that's the coolest about it is you're giving it to the people that are running like a soup kitchen in the downtown east side here, and you immediately see like, there, I've done a thing. And there is a tendency, there is like a sense of like, well, I can Instagram this and be seen to be doing good. There is right. That component to it.
For sure.
But you know what? Sometimes That's just the way the world works. And you can do it and not post, or you can do it in post. Doesn't matter. You've done something, and doing something is better than doing nothing. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do it in post. That way other people look at it and go, oh, I could do that.
I can do that. Yeah. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.